Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Forecast for agricultural exports for fiscal year 23 is $184.5 billion, which is down 6% from 2022.
USDA economist Mark Kenner.
Exports of wheat for October through January 2023 were $2.3 billion. That's up 11% from the previous year of $2.1 billion. Exports of corn were $3.8 billion, down 27% from the previous year of $5.2 billion. Soybean exports were $21.5 billion, up 15% from the previous year of $18.7 billion. And cotton exports were $1.7 billion, up 2% from the previous year of $1.7 billion.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The U.S. Trade Representative's Office has initiated action against Mexico regarding the country's decree that would limit and eventually stop U.S. corn exports to Mexico. Dave Salmonson, AFBF Senior Government Affairs Director, says USTR's effort is under the authority of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement.
The first thing that's done is what's called a request for consultations. That can take several months if necessary. Then, if the issue isn't resolved, they move on to a dispute resolution panel. So USTR this week has started the process to try to get this issue with Mexico resolved.
Mexico first issued a decree to limit the import of biotech corn in 2020.
Part of what the Mexican government was looking at was the use of glyphosate. Of course, the U.S. produces a lot of corn that is exported to Mexico. It's our number one export market. So anything that would limit those exports is, of course, a big concern. And the fact that it was on such a non-scientific basis, we can see it as just being an attempt to limit trade.
Salmonson adds discussions with Mexico on the issue will continue.
The resolution we'd be looking for is for Mexico to either withdraw them or change them so that it won't have an impact on U.S. exports. There is time for discussion, but if the discussions aren't fruitful, then the U.S. can take the action of calling for a dispute panel and getting a ruling on what Mexico has done. So there's still plenty to happen going forward.
Michael Clements, Washington.
Trade is an important aspect. The other side of the equation is, what will we grow? Allendale out of McHenry, Illinois, has released their 2023 acreage survey results. Rich Nelson is chief strategist with Allendale.
For the spring acreage survey, this is quite important to point out because this survey has accurately found the direction of corn acres up or down 9 of the past 10 years. Our soybean survey has found accurately up or down acreage in 8 of the past 10 years. So I think in terms of this year's survey, which is over 20 years in existence, this is going to be a very big deal.
So to the numbers that are now out on the acreage survey, and Allendale's survey results for corn, a 1.8 million acre increase for corn over 2022. That is less than what USDA has projected in the Ag Forum. But again, USDA's estimates, next estimates, are set to come out at the end of the month. Again, Allendale expecting 90,414,000 acres of corn, 1.8 million more than planted last year. For soybeans, the acreage would be up 318,000 acres over last year at 87,768,000. Wheat, up nearly 3 million acres for all wheat, led by winter wheat acres, which are up 3.25 million acres. The all-wheat acreage at 48,706,000 acres, again, according to Allendale's acreage survey. So what would this be potentially looking at production? Well, the implied production using the survey numbers and USDA's trend yield would have a production of just under 15 billion bushels for corn, soybeans at 4.5, wheat 1.8. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, the president often talks about rebuilding the middle class of this country. He talks about bottom up and middle out.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking at Commodity Classic.
Rebuilding the great middle class, because he believes, and I believe, and I suspect you do too, that one of the critical components of the success of America has been the fact that we've had a strong middle class. Folks who get up every single day, who work hard, play by the rules, and have at their very core the desire to make sure that their children and grandchildren have a better future. It's part of the secret sauce of our great country. And there's no greater representative of that middle class than Americans, farmers, ranchers, and producers, in my view. And this came to light recently when I was looking at income statistics that were reported to me in the office of secretary. And folks came in and they were kind of excited. They said, Mr. Secretary, we want you to know the last 2 years have been the best 2 years in farm income in the history of the United States. And I thought to myself, gee, if I give speeches and I start with that, again, I should probably walk off the stage to applause. But then I looked deeper into the numbers. And here's what I found. And here's why I'm here today. What I found was that in that record set of years, nearly 50% of our farmers, ranchers, and producers lost money. Another nearly 40% of those who work hard every single day made some money from their farm, but the majority of money that they made for their family, that supported their family, came from off-farm income. So nearly 90% of those who work hard every single day to produce this incredible bounty either didn't make money or didn't make the majority of the money that they made from farming during record income levels, which meant that the top 10%, the folks who sell more than $1 million of product every year, did very well, and about 40% of those folks are actually investment bankers, folks who own land. So I thought about this notion of bottom up and middle out. It seems to me that we need to look at why that is so. Why in a record year a few folks benefit, but not many or most. In my lifetime, the productivity of American farming has increased 17 times. It is a remarkable story of productivity. But the reality is that the more productive we became, the more expensive it was. And so it became necessary for folks to look at and to think about spreading the cost of that over a larger and larger base. And with that, we had larger and larger farms and fewer farmers. And it wasn't just the impact on the farmers. It was the impact on the communities where those farmers lived, those small towns, because if there are fewer farmers, then there are fewer customers for that small town business on the main street. There are fewer kids in the school. There are fewer folks living in the community that can support a hospital and a number of docks. And so rural America, which is, I think, the heartbeat of this notion of a middle class, began to be challenged.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This term that we see a lot, the dollar value of about $20 per ton. And that range, you'll see a range from $18 to $22. That's really become a price or a value that's been quoted a lot in the marketplace.
Dr. David Anderson is a Texas A&M livestock economist talking about carbon capture and credit markets.
I think it's very important to realize that, again, to reiterate what Tiffany said, in dollars per ton, if the change in carbon in your soil that you're looking at is 0.1 ton, then that change, that value per acre, is going to be about $2. So we're really talking about this in terms of the change you're going to provide. Again, dovetailing with this production risk that Jason talked about, with this value in the marketplace of really $20 per ton. So again, that idea of change, the increase in production, and this is really the marketplace that we're seeing right now. So again, I think there's a couple of important parts here. The companies, a Google or whoever who are buying these may very well be paying much more for that dollars per ton, but these companies in the middle who are putting this together and making this market happen have costs as well. And so we're getting to this idea of this $20 per ton net to a farmer or rancher. On this production risk idea, lots of ag practices can store carbon, as we've talked about. And what I would get us to think about is that we are competing in this marketplace, as either we think of it as ranchers or as the rangeland, the rangeland's ability to increase carbon storage. We are competing in a marketplace, with all the way from forestry and trees, row cropping systems, to a lot of other more high tech systems for pulling carbon out of the air. And if we think about in this marketplace, every one of these practices has a cost with them to provide. This $20 per ton of carbon in the marketplace then really kind of dictates what kind of practices we're going to see first. And the ones that are the lowest cost to provide, or that can be profitably provided at $20 per ton, is what's going to happen first. So, you know, I would work into this. I think it's very important as we figure out, am I changing my practices on the ranch, my grazing system, whatever it is I'm doing to increase soil carbon storage to then generate this carbon payment? I would really strongly urge the thing to think about is those practices that you're putting in place have to be profitable to do. If we think of this $20 per ton and the net price being some fraction of that based on how much the increase in carbon you can get, some of those dollars, if, for example, if it's 0.1 ton, it's $2 per acre. That's not a lot of money in terms if we think about increasing or changing our system of production that may very well change our costs, but also may change our returns. So I want to think about this, not just signing a contract and getting a check, but how it fits into the total ranch operation so that the practice you're putting in place is profitable to do so first. I think that's really a kind of a critical thing to think about in this market.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A new memorandum of understanding between the American Farm Bureau Federation, Case IH, and New Holland provides farmers and ranchers the right to repair their own farm equipment. Sam Kiefer, Vice President of Public Policy for the American Farm Bureau, talks about how the agreement will benefit U.S. farmers and ranchers.
This agreement follows a previous agreement with John Deere that now represents more than half of the farm market share in the United States. And combined, these agreements ensure that farmers have the right to repair their own equipment, either individually or through independent repair shops, by giving them assurances to have access to diagnostic codes and what they mean, specialty tools, parts, information, manuals, things of that nature.
Kiefer says the memorandum with Case IH and New Holland is similar to the one with John Deere.
In focusing on making sure that individuals have the right to repair their equipment, as well as the opportunity to lean on a trusted advisor, be it in an independent repair shop, to make those repairs for them.
He talks about the next steps in moving forward with Case IH, Deere, and potentially other manufacturers.
As the conversations continue with Case and with John Deere, we will be interacting as an organization on behalf of our members with the manufacturers. The agreement indicates that we'll be meeting regularly, at least biannually, to discuss how it's going, the experiences of our members. And as technology emerges and there's new capabilities and challenges, we'll be discussing those and identifying if we need to improve, tweak specific items within the MOU. And we will continue to engage in conversations with other manufacturers on behalf of our members.
For more information on the MOU, go to fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
Gwen Euker is with USDA's Farm Service Agency.
We have access for our customers to a website called farmers.gov. It allows customers to access their personal farm FSA farm records information through a secure, authenticated portal. And from that portal, they can actually see their farm records data. They can see their maps. They can print their maps. Right now, it saves them a trip to the office if all they want to do is print their map. In addition to printing maps, they can also create areas of interest. So if I want to draw out an area of interest that I send to my fertilizer guy saying, I want you to spread fertilizer on these 50 acres, I can print that map out. It'll have the area marked. It'll say how many acres, and you can send it directly to them. You can also import your precision ag farm boundaries, print them on the map, email that to your county office as part of your acreage reporting process. You can add labels to your map that says, I planted wheat on such and such a date, and I have 100% interest in it, which is all information we need for acreage reporting. You can put that on your map. Now you have a digital copy of your map with all your acreage reporting information that you can email to your county office in preparation for reporting acreage.
How will producers get started?
They need to go to eauth.gov, which is a website to get yourself identity proofed and a login. And you go through the identity proofing process. You have your eauth login, which is what you need to log into the website. And it will take your eauth login and link it to your FSA business partner record. So when you log into farmers.gov, it knows exactly who you are, and it displays just the information associated with you. So it's a secure site. You don't have to worry about anybody else seeing your information. Once you're logged in, you'll see your own data.
What about partnerships?
So if you're a member of an entity or if you have power of attorney for someone, we have the ability in the application, if you have that authority on file with FSA, you can actually, what we call switch profiles. So you can change your profile to be you're logged in as you, but you can see your entity's information or the information for the people that you will have authority to act on behalf of. So when you log in, you switch profiles, and it'll bring up their farm records based on their business partner ID. So you can actually act on behalf of any of other people from this website too.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Historically, the focus has been on trying to figure out ways to help farmers stay in business.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking to the crowd recently at Commodity Classic.
We look at ways to reduce inputs. And we're doing that. We just recently announced, not long ago, a fertilizer initiative, understanding, appreciating the amazing pressure farmers were under with the Ukrainian circumstance and conflict and war. We saw a tremendous increase and spike in fertilizer costs, affecting every agricultural production system in the country. So we announced the notion of looking for ways where we could immediately identify programs and opportunities to increase production here in the U.S. and then a longer-term strategy. We divided a $500 million effort into two phases. Phase one was, what can you do now for 23 and 24 crop year, and what can you do long-term to make us more self-reliant when it comes to inputs? And today we're announcing $29 million of grants into eight independent businesses that are located in the states of Alabama, Colorado, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Washington, where resources are going to be used to modernize equipment, to advance climate smart practices, to build production operations and facilities, and to expand the capacity of fertilizer production here in the United States. For example, Purcell Agritech, which is a facility located in Alabama, is going to focus on increasing the productivity and production of controlled-release fertilizer. They hope to be able to increase their supply by as much as 40,000 tons with the small grant that we're providing. There's a facility in Missouri that's focused on a microbial fertilizer, where they're producing about 8,000 gallons of that a week now. They feel with the grant we're giving them, they could increase to 120,000 gallons a week. There's another facility in Missouri as well that's constructing a new plant, and with our grant they're going to be able to accelerate the timeline to be able to impact and affect probably 24 crops. So we are in the process of trying to work and focus on reducing input costs. And our phase two portion of this effort, we received $3 billion in requests, 350 applications over 47 states and two territories. So there's genuine interest in this, and we're going to continue to try to figure out ways in which we can provide support and help to reduce inputs.
Another area he says USDA has been focused on is growing trade opportunities.
You know, clearly we understand the importance of trade, and we've had record years. The last 2 years have been record years in trade. And it's fairly clear that we believe in a science-based and rules-based system. It's fundamental to our approach to trade. And so when Mexico and the Mexican president issued his decree, raising concerns and doubts about the safety of biotechnology corn, suggesting bans or the lack of use of that corn, we felt that there was not a scientific basis for that decree. We questioned it. We asked the president to reconsider. He was unwilling to do that, and so we began with the U.S. Trade Representative's Office the formal process under USMCA in a consultation to make sure that we defend the notion of a science-based trading system, that we send a strong message to the world about the safety of biotech products, and we ensure that we continue to have market access.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I basically have set up an outline that is the known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns of the science on soil carbon based on our former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
That's Iowa State agronomist Marshall McDaniel on the science behind soil carbon credits.
The known known that we know is that conservation practices on average increase soil organic carbon. And that's based on hundreds and hundreds of individual studies that are aggregated into what are called meta-analyses. And we know on average practices like no-till, cover crops, and adding manure can increase soil carbon from 0.1 to greater than 1 megagram or a ton of carbon per hectare per year. Some of the unknown unknowns is that monitoring that change in soil organic carbon is very challenging due just to the inherent spatial variability or how variable it is within a farm field. Soil organic carbon changes very slowly. And then places like Iowa, where we have these very rich mollisols pictured here in the bottom right, the amount of organic carbon is already very high and can make monitoring changes very challenging. The other kind of known unknowns with the science on soil carbon is that there are co-benefits and trade-offs with these management practices that increase soil organic carbon. So co-benefits are other important agronomic or environmental benefits of these soil health practices that are not related to carbon, like maybe reducing nutrient leaching or improving water holding capacity, whereas trade-offs are things that are negative that also come along with some of these conservation practices that increase soil organic carbon, and that might be a decrease in yield. Some of the unknown unknowns are how is government involvement going to change? And that will really affect how these carbon markets fluctuate and how we monitor and report and verify changes in soil carbon. And then another kind of unknown unknown is rapidly developing technologies to quickly measure soil organic carbon. And this could improve the challenge and the known unknown of monitoring soil organic carbon change.
Now, Iowa State Extension Specialist Dan Anderson on greenhouse gas emissions from livestock.
We're really talking about how does carbon, nitrogen, and energy move through my farm and my manure storage system. What we're trying to do with livestock production is take plant feedstuffs, convert it into meat, milk, and eggs, and have a tasty product. As part of that, we do generate some manure. That manure can have a substantial impact on our greenhouse gas footprint, especially in how much methane and N2O we make. The choices we make in what our facility looks like and how we're treating that manure have a huge impact on how much methane we actually make. Here in Iowa, we have lots of choices for manure systems ranging from a bedded pack solid manure system to deep pit liquid manure systems. What we tend to see is that those liquid systems make more methane, and because of that, we have opportunities to do things like solid liquid separation, covering those liquid storages that will alter how much methane and N2O we make, changing our greenhouse gas footprint. There are opportunities in the carbon market to sell those voluntarily to companies looking to improve their sustainability footprint or work to get that as a fuel source supplied to gas pipelines throughout the state to collect RIN or LCFS credits. And this LCFS market has looked relatively lucrative for livestock farms and allowed us especially to think about what are some potential opportunities we have to improve our environmental footprint while also increasing our sustainability. The markets are still relatively early, relatively new, but there are lots of opportunities there.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Although USDA's recent weekly export sales reports show a slowdown in U.S. ag exports, the latest complete trade numbers we have are for January, and what a way to start the new year, $17 billion worth of ag export business.
By far, and by far I mean over $1 billion, the best January on record.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says for the first 4 months of this fiscal year, October through January, the U.S. sold into export ag products worth $69 billion.
And that is a 32% increase over the $52.4 billion of last year.
So exports during the first 4 months of the 2023 fiscal year did show plenty of strength, but
there is an expectation that things are slowing down going forward.
That's reflected in USDA's new export forecast issued just a couple of weeks ago, forecasting exports for the year $184.5 billion, 6% below 2022's record. Gary Crawford, Washington.